Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. Well, hello and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 173. We are in the beginnings of August, and I'd like to say hi to everybody out there who has been listening for some time. Hello to the new listeners as well. What we try to do here on the Disciplined Investor is very simple. A little bit of education, hopefully some money-making opportunities, bring on some great guests that could share some good knowledge. You know, a lot of times when you see them on the TV, whether it's Bloomberg, CNBC, you read some of their quotes, you're only getting a little snippet. But what we try to do is spend a little more time with them and have the opportunity to really delve deeper into what they're thinking, how they're trading it, and how we can then translate it to make money for all of us, okay? Well, we have two great guests today, and it's very, very timely. First up, we're going to talk with a gentleman who hasn't been here with us for a while. His name is Dennis Gartman. He writes the Gartman Letter. He is an expert and an internationally respected man when it comes to the entire area of commodities, in particular when it comes to grains, gold, you know, steel, et cetera, et cetera. Pair trading is also, and currency trading is also something that he really specializes in. And then we're going to bring in a trader, Tommy Grisafi. We've had him on before. And Tommy is actually in the pits. He's got his shirt rolled up, and he's really in there with live trades, acting on them in a very big way usually. And we're going to speak to him about some of the green things that I have in my mind, questions about what's happening with wheat, with Russia, etc. And we're going to try to tie that all together. It's been a wild week when it comes to the ups and downs in the global markets. Clearly, we're seeing China do a lot better these days. There's excitement about Europe, which we'll get into in a minute because I'm going to really kind of kibosh that whole issue. And there's been an up and down in our markets, a lot of anticipation in the domestic markets over better than expected economic numbers. And clearly, 78% of the S&P 500 that have already reported, about 400 companies, have actually beat estimates by a decent margin and in terms of revenue coming in pretty well as well. So that's been really charging the markets of late, and what we're seeing now is kind of the anticlimactic level of a market that has been overbought for some time, and it's driving it down after we saw those non-farm payroll numbers. So I thought we'd start off with that discussion and then weave in and out of some of the other things that are going on and talk to you a little bit about Europe, and then we'll get right into our guests and then wrap it all up. So when it comes to the non-farm payroll numbers, you know, it was pretty disappointing on Friday because, you know, when you think about what was going on and we've seen this kind of slow but sure progression better, well, we were thinking that there was going to be some kind of benefit and a better opportunity that maybe there would be some betterment in the change in private payrolls. Now, that was not necessarily our thinking, but that was the thinking of the markets, and there was a lot of anticipation put into that. A lot of people on the analyst side and investors were hoping, and that was a bad word to use, but they were hoping that we would see some miracle, I think, here. Because when you look at the non-farm payrolls, what they anticipated, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of about a loss of 65,000. Now, remember something. It was June, July, and August. June, July, and August would have seen the greatest amount of potential layoffs in government employees because the temporary census workers were no longer going to be involved with the census. It's over. So those layoffs were going to happen. Okay, fine. But there was the idea that we would see about a 71,000 change in private payrolls after about 83,000 were added last month. But let me give you the actual numbers. This is what really spooked the markets and, frankly, is not giving us a real good sense that there is an opportunity to see a return to any kind of level of reasonable employment. And let me tell you why. Here's what happened. So the prior numbers on the change in non-farm payrolls last month was a negative 125,000. Okay. They actually came in this month at a negative 131, so it was a little bit worse. But really, the problem here was the revised numbers. When you look at the revised numbers from last month, which was said initially on the report that it was a negative 125,000, they revised it down to a negative 221,000. The survey this month thought there would be a negative 65,000. It came in a negative 131, double the amount. Here's where the rub is. The change in private payrolls, which is non-government, you strip it out, showed there was a 71,000 gain in employment. The survey thought it would be 90,000, but the prior was 83,000, so we fell low of both of those, but the revision to last month went from an 83,000 only to 31,000. Very, very poor showing. The revisions were much worse than even the headline miss on the change in non-farm payrolls overall. There was, if you wanted to say, okay, was there anything positive in this report? Clearly, there were a couple things. First of all, you had that the unemployment rate stuck at 9.5, but put that aside for a second. That's good. The change in the manufacturing payrolls went from a 13,000 plus to a 36,000 against the expectations. So that's very good. Prior was a 9,000 and revised upward to 13,000 plus. Great numbers. So the idea that the continuation of growth in manufacturing, maybe for an inventory restocking cycle, is there. Now, when it comes to average hourly earnings, we saw an uptick. The survey thought we'd see about a 0.10, actually doubled, 0.20, and the revision was better as well. But more importantly, we're seeing the average weekly hours worked go flat, didn't reduce from a 34 to a 34.1, 34.2, excuse me. The good news there is that there's more money in the pockets of the people that are actually working. There's not enough people working, but there's more money in the pockets of each of the people working. So that really was a problem overall because the numbers were extremely disappointing on the private payroll side. Now, if you want to take a look at this, we put a little table together. It's available on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can get to that by just going to the show notes and clicking on this episode, episode number 173. At thedisciplinedinvestor.com and looking at that table about halfway down. So you can take a look. I think it's important because we color-coded some of that to show just how bad the numbers actually were when it came to the revisions and the miss on the headline numbers. But here's the question. How much longer can we actually see the non-farm payrolls stay where they are here and the change in private payrolls be as ugly as they are, initial claims being in the 470,000 range on a weekly basis, and keep on saying that we have a jobless recovery that will continue? We're at an inflection point, folks. What I think really where we're at right now is a really difficult time and a head-scratcher because the concerns about the employment are going to start putting a damper on spending overall. Companies are going to question whether or not they can continue making money by cutting expenses and by, you know, seeing a limited amount of revenue. Now, listen, 400-plus companies already reported from the S&P 500, right? We said that 78% have actually beat their estimates. That's great. But how much longer can that actually go if we do not see the workforce really participating and seeing additional revenue in the pocket of the people and the revenue then coming out of the pocket to the, you know, whether it's spending in on any area, clothes, something in the housing area or food, whatever it may be. There's going to be a slowdown in the spending area as well. Let's just face that fact. Recently, Goldman Sachs, I think it was Friday, said that they're reducing their GDP annualized number from 2.4 to 1.9%. One of the reasons they did so was because they believe that this current political environment has provided a roadblock that the current people in office, whether it's Congress and the president, administration, et cetera, will not have the will to actually do what is necessary to re-stimulate the economy. There's been too much spending that has gone on, and most people believe that the spending that has gone on has been done recklessly. We saw the $750 billion that was recently spent on that stimulus package really just disappear, just like supposedly the BP oil disappeared, and really not get a lot of jobs. No matter what you want to say, no matter how they want to slice it and dice it and make it look, the fact is we do not have a good level of jobs and employment now. President Obama has, in my opinion, failed on this in this matter, and his administration is trying to do whatever they can to make it look better. But the fact of the matter is that we need to have cuts in taxes and direct line stimulus to things like infrastructure development if they want to succeed. There's going to be a need for a substantial amount of money to the states. $300 billion or so is the number that there is a shortfall on with all the states to meet their current budgets. Where is that going to come from? So it's going to come from either expense cutting, but there's not enough expense cutting to get to that point, or the government's going to have to kick in there too. The question then becomes, when looked at by the individual, by the voter, is the money being spent recklessly or constructively? And right now, the big vote is on the reckless side. People don't understand how we're not getting bang for the buck. We look at other countries and we're seeing what's going on there, particularly in Asia, and they did get that. Latin America did get that. Even to an extent, the euro got propped up by a big backstop. How long that's going to last, we'll talk about in a minute. But that's what's been going on, and right now, it appears to us that even though we're seeing some of the manufacturing numbers hold on, much of the economics are going to start rolling over into the fourth quarter, which is what we've always predicted. And that's when it's going to be time to really set the stage to protect the portfolios that you have, because it's going to be a time when we're not going to be able to see the earnings, really the earnings growth at all for the next few quarters after that, keep pace with what's gone on. So this is just a taste, I believe, of what's going to happen moving forward. And what we're really going to have to pay attention to right now is how the economics will bleed over like they do, because economics and fundamentals usually meet sometime in the future. They could really play the game of not having a lot of effect on the immediate stock market, but eventually things catch up to each other. Now let's kind of shift over to the euro for a second. Now the euro has been on a rise. I mean, it hit 133 or so. I mean, from 118 to 133, I mean, we're seeing remarkable strength in the euro, and there's some talk that the European zone is actually better, more on better solid footing than the U.S. right now. No, I don't think so. The fact of the matter is, in my opinion right now, we're going to see a rollover of the euro. We're going to see a front loading. If we look back, a few months from now, and we say, okay, what happened? Well, because the euro was so cheap, 118, 119, 120, a lot of players went in there and bought the product because it was on sale. If you had a currency that was worth a lot more comparatively, you could effectively go in and get a 10, 15% discount from where it was just a few months ago and get a great deal. Lock in the payment, lock in the price, and get whatever you want manufactured. I think that's what's gone on, and we're going to see a front loading of the numbers. Trichet even came out and said that there was a better than expected numbers in the recent quarter and what he's seeing for the next quarter. And a lot of that, in our opinion, is due to the fact that there was this lower value of the euro. People saw that as a credit, if you will. And we're going to see what happened with the cash for clunkers credit and the housing credit. We're going to see a big fall down the next quarter. So we have about a 1 to 2 month period here where we'll see a little bit of movement and a benefit to some of the numbers when backward looking at some of the manufacturing, some of the sales numbers, etc. But then because of the austerity programs and because of what's gone on in Europe, the higher level of the euro right now, everything's going to reverse itself. That's what our prediction is, and that's how we're going to play it. So you got to look into shorting some of the European countries, particularly some of the bigger countries out there, or just use an ETF that will actually short the whole region if you can. And you know, we can give you some ideas on that too, maybe in some later shows as it gets closer to that point. We're not there yet. But as it gets closer to that point, you got to be more and more careful to take money off the table in Europe. Right now, until then, as the euro is holding up pretty well, you're getting a great bang for your buck because you got the benefit of the euro increasing in value, and at the same time, markets have been very strong right there. And in addition to that, don't forget that we also had the bogus stress test that went on inside of Europe. Probably, it makes ours look almost solid. You know, the stress tests that were done here in the United States were questionable at the time they were done as well. But you look at the stress tests that were done in Europe, and you have to wonder for a second, was this you know, backward adjusted? Was this manufactured in such a way that it was meant to only fail the banks that they wanted to fail? It does appear that way. So you have to look at what's gone on as a manipulated and, I would say, staged. Staged is probably the best way to look at it. A staged way of creating a better-looking banking system and to strengthen the euro. And that being the case, that's what's gone on. Don't forget that pretty much investors will oftentimes believe what's being shoveled at them, especially if it comes from a government. Now, how long that will last is yet to be seen, but right now we just do not see the benefit in the euro. We think that the dollar will strengthen moving forward. We're actually short oil right now, and that's actually paying off really nicely. We were long oil for a few weeks, made about a 15% gain on it through that nice little ride, and we actually shorted it close to where it is about now, right at about 80. And we are looking to continue with that if the dollar is going to strengthen. The euro itself probably be very, very volatile because the carry trade as well as unwinding of the trade. And then if it starts getting hit again, that euro will come down pretty strong. And I think there's a lot of players out there that are just waiting for some vulnerability and waiting for it to weaken. And you'll see that come along and really get it hit. Couple things I want to mention to you before we get to our guests. We have some great shows lined up. We have Satyajit Das coming, or you know him as Das, coming next week. We also have Kate Stalter lined up. We also have Kevin DePue of Minionville, as well as Terry Bedford, who pretty much on the dime on this show called the top of the market in the plus 1200 level on the S&P 500. And he's going to come back. We're going to find out where he actually is investing and what directional bets he's placing on the markets. All right, what else do we have here? We know about the Russian drought. We know what's going on there. We know about the food pricing. We'll get into that a little bit with our commodity traders, Dennis Gartman, and with Tommy Grisafi in a couple of minutes. What else did I want to mention to you? Oh, I did want to mention something. Thanks so much for the emails that came in. The last week's episode, we had a couple of screens, and Kevin Hoffman in my office and I were talking about what was going on and how to look at some short squeeze opportunities, et cetera, and just some screens to set up. And we did some page snaps and some instructions, and we fed it through the iTunes and through the RSS feed. And I wanted to get some feedback as to whether anybody actually received those and whether they actually received the PDF file, because right now all we do is pump through MP3 format, right? The audio format. So we got a lot of emails back. A lot of people told us, yes, it did come through. They could not see it on their iPhone. I tried the same thing on my iPhone. I couldn't see the actual document, but on their computer, through iTunes, all that was available, and we got some really good feedback that people really liked that we could actually pump through data like that directly through the stream. So in the future, we'll continue to do that, and thank you for your emails. We got a lot of emails on that. Thank you so much for your emails on that topic. We also got a lot of emails in from you on questions that you had. Of course, if you have any questions, all you have to do is write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This one came in. We had a question from Tim Honda. He says, "Dear Andrew, I've listened to your podcast about a year and a half. You're doing a great job. Keep it up. Thank you, sir. It's my belief that U.S. Treasuries, TLT, will eventually go through a sort of crisis someday in the future. Maybe not as bad as Greece, but who knows? And I'm trying to figure out if this will have a negative or positive effect on us, on the stocks, U.S. stocks, S&P 500. I think Peter Schiff would say U.S. debt crisis will lead to hyperinflation, stocks going up, etc. My question, what do you think? Hypothetically, a U.S. Treasury debt crisis leads to an S&P up or down." Well, I would think, obviously, if there's a debt crisis in the United States, let's make this easy to understand. If there's a debt crisis in the U.S., let's think of it like the debt crisis that we saw in Greece and Dubai around Eurozone, etc. What happened there? It's not good for stocks, right? Because if there's a debt crisis here, there's a lack of certainty. There's a lack of conviction. There's just a lack of ability for anybody to find a good place to put money. People are going to go to cash, gold, and things of that nature, not to stocks. Stocks will be thrown right out the window. I'll tell you that much, my friend. So I just don't see that really happening. I don't see the thesis happening at all. But more than not, the thesis happening about a debt crisis as grand as we saw in Dubai or as in Greece, I just don't see how the stock market could actually go up in that. So that's, I think, an interesting play right there to think about, and or at least to consider. We have an interesting comment from, who is this from? Trader Time says, what do you mean there's no depression about TDI podcast number 171? Where are the breadlines? That's what I think that Mike Santoli said. And the response was the government hid the breadlines. We had breadlines that could have called food stamps. And according to this gent here, the food stamps program has about 37.9 million people, about 1 in 8 Americans receiving food stamps to help buy food. And the enrollment set a record for the 9th month in a row last month. Kind of interesting. And also, let's see what here I have. Okay, this is from James Holson. He says, thanks for the reply. I replied to him on an email. He says, in my opinion, it would be good if you would talk about volume issues on your podcast, not because I want my question to be read, but because it's been brought up so many times since we came off the March 2009 lows. People look at volume in different ways and use different criteria for how they use it, such as IBD wanting a breakout to occur on 50% greater or average volume, or someone wanting to test the swing point low on at least 10% lighter volume. Since there you are one of the few reliable individuals in the financial industry that I believe it would be good for your listeners to hear what you say. You know, thank you so much, by the way, for that note and kind words. Here's you know, the problem with volume, there's a problem with volume. And the problem is it's become very unreliable. We've had a lot of people on the show that have talked about volume. Unfortunately, a lot of people are pretty much have just capitulated and say that volume doesn't matter anymore when it was all that did matter for a while. What we've seen lately is that we are seeing a heightened level of volume on low days, market down days, if you will, and low volume on the higher days, market moving up. The problem is that there seems to be complacency. Market days moving up, people just, you know, are not selling and they're just doing what they're doing and they're letting things ride. Markets moving down, though, has people kind of trading a lot more. You buy the dips. So volume, I think, is not only from selling per se, but it's this combination of more people involved. Does that make any sense? You know, you have more action. You have more people involved. You have more trading going on the down days because there's a lot of dip buying that goes on, whereas the up days, people are just not really selling that much. There's a complacency in this market. But that doesn't mean, that does not mean that necessarily it's okay. What I would like to see is a reasonable amount of volume to then show me what is actually happening, particularly by institutions. When you look on a stock-by-stock basis, we do want to see increasing volume on an up day to show us that there is more than just total complacency, more than just a simple short squeeze. We want to see there's actual buyers coming in to make those trades, and they're buying it with real significant money. Because if we see that, if we see that there is higher volume on an up day for an individual stock, and we can then tie that to individual institutional buying, we could say that there will be a support level for that particular stock. Remember, there's a tremendous amount of money with the institutions. I'm not talking about 100 shares, 200 share purchase here. No, no, no. We're talking about millions of share purchases. If they want to keep the stock up, they can do so. If they want to, they have so much money at their hand, at their disposal and in their hands ready to buy that they could actually create a support zone for those stocks. So if institutionals are buying it, we like it. We just ride their coattails a little bit, if possible. Now, at the same time, more institutions own a stock. If a stock starts to become out of favor, you may see a volume pick up there because institutionals are dumping. So I think that when looking at an individual stock, for the most part, you can look at volumes as a little bit more reliable, kind of a secondary confirmation of direction. The markets these days have been at best confusing. They're confounding and confusing even the most seasoned experts when it comes to this whole volume question. I'm still in the camp that it matters. I would like to see markets have higher volume days than low days to confirm. But if not, the trend is still the trend. Right? Does that make sense? So I hope that answers your question. And I hope that that gives you a little bit better insight here that, you know, when you're looking at the volume. But I think there's a lot of circumstances when it comes to what's actually happening. If you just look at, as Brian Shannon would say, the price is all that matters. That's important. But looking at, if you will, the volume, which is a measure of supply and demand, and you look at the demand, which is really not there sometimes. And when you see the opposite occur, you have to realize that there's a lot more fear in this market than there is euphoria. A lot more fear of things going down. And who can blame anybody? Look what happened a couple of years ago. So with that, let's take a break, or at least get a segue to our The people we want to talk to, Dennis Gartman, who is our first guest up today, and then Tommy Grisafi from the Indiana Grain Company. And if you listen in, we'll have, actually on the website, I'll have the free offer from Dennis Gartman to get his market letter. Now, if nothing else, you want to check that out. This is a great opportunity for you to track what he's talking about. A great and prolific writer and someone who really has great insight into the area of commodities. So I would suggest very strongly you check that link out on The Disciplined Investor. And I look forward to talking with these guys because I have lots of questions about Russia and what's happening with wheat, some opportunities that we may have in shorting some areas, and where is the next opportunity when it comes to the commodity space. Stick around. We'll be right back on The Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm going to segue right into a discussion about what's going on in the commodity space, and who better than to talk about it? And a good friend of mine and someone who's a little bit under the weather today, Dennis Gartman. How you feeling, buddy?
Oh, got a bad summer cold or the flu or whatever, but I'll be fine.
All right, so let's talk and let's get right into this. There's a lot of talk going on about what's happening with the euro, and you know, we see the unemployment claims come out this week, and the euro's starting to move, and then that affects oil, it affects everything. But the big thing right now is what's going on in Russia, the drought, the fires, and what's going on with wheat. Is this sustainable? Is this these you know, up days for wheat? How is this going to play out?
I think this is more than just the Russian drought and the demise, literally the demise of the Russian crop. You also have done damage, severe damage to the Ukrainian crop. You've done enormous damage to the Kazakhstani crop. We tend to forget that although the United States is the number one exporter, there are a great number of countries right below us who export wheat to the rest of the world, and you have taken a good portion of the world's exportable wheat and destroyed it. Mother Nature has really wreaked havoc. So this is something that's not going to go away anytime soon. This is a tectonic plate shift underneath the commodity market that I think has longer-term implications rather than just a $3 rise in the wheat market.
You know, I wrote a piece recently, and we do a quarterly economic report and look back and commentary, and I talked about one of the interesting similarities. This is a little bit overplayed, but between the, you know, what happened recently in the Depression was that we had all these things happen, unemployment and bank collapses, but the final nail in the coffin was the Dust Bowl that we saw. And, you know, do you think this is going to damage the economics of the world in any way by, you know, creating a artificial inflationary pressure on food products?
Well, remember, I am a monetarist at heart, and inflation always and everywhere, as the professor told us, is a monetary phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Unless the monetary aggregates are increasing at a pace faster than GDP, it is, you don't get inflation. And let's think about it in these terms. The monetary base has grown nothing at all since last October. It has gone absolutely sideways, no growth whatsoever.
Right.
If that has occurred, and you have Mother Nature creating a problem in the wheat market, which has forced wheat prices up, unless there's more money to pay for that wheat, other commodity prices must go down. It's not an inflationary concern at all unless the monetary authorities make it such, and right now the monetary authorities are not doing that.
Right. You recently wrote or were quoted in Bloomberg this week. You said exactly this, quote, "You have a situation unlike anything that I've seen in the 35 years I've been trading in the grain markets, and this is going to be one of the great years for the American agriculture, probably in history." Let's not mince words here. So, you know, we're looking at things like Archer Daniels, maybe even some secondary plays like Bunge and maybe some of the Fertz, Potash, Mosaic, etc. Is there a play here? I know you love doing your offset trades and, you know, something like shorting General Mills, shorting Kellogg, going long, let's say, Archer Daniels.
That's not a bad idea. The place that I'm taking a look at right now is, who are the beneficiaries? And it seems to me that the beneficiaries are going to be those people who export grain and those people who sell fertilizer. And quite honestly, there's only one company in the country that does that. It's very thinly traded, but it's the Andersons, a nice family out of Toledo, Ohio. Grain elevators all around the country sell fertilizer to the rest of the world, export grain. They're going to do very well in this. The other thing that people have not thought about is that this is going to reliquify the banking system in the Midwest. So as I tell people, the real beneficiaries for the long run are the small Midwestern banks that heretofore have been under pressure. They're going to have a wonderful several years. So go out and buy your local bank. If there is such a thing as the First National Bank of Keokuk, Iowa, go buy it. If there is such a thing as the People's Bank and Trust of Ottumwa, Iowa, go buy it. They're going to have a gangbuster series of years, and that will be the quiet, slow, pleasant, dividend-paying, let's do the country a favor type of trade.
Yeah, this is definitely, I can definitely see that whole farming region for the U.S. now. Of course, this is different than the Dust Bowl, which happened in the Midwest. Speaking of a little dust there. You know, this is the opposite happening in Russia. I mean, this is a real scenario, a serious scenario. And, you know, this is just goes hand in hand once again with the, you know, we had the BP situation, which, by the way, I don't know what your commentary is on this, but magically 75% of the oil has disappeared.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's fabulous. Because they didn't even know what the real number was to begin with of how much flowed. So how can you come up with a number? By the way, it wasn't 75, it was 74. Kind of to make it look a little bit like it wasn't as made up, I guess.
Yes.
But is oil going to be stretching here? I mean, right now we're seeing the dollar get just destroyed. Particularly, well, let's look at it differently. The euro is getting squeezed all the way to 133 plus. Is that on the fact that the U.S. is much weaker, or is it on the fact that, you know, everybody believes that the euro is stronger, or is the carry trade just back in action?
Well, I think what you've had, let's be honest here. A year ago, we were trading 160 to the euro.
Mm-hmm.
We took it all the way to 119 to the euro. The fact that we've bounced back to 133 is less than a 50% correction. I still think that the euro has egregious problems. Europe has enormous problems. And for the last 2 weeks, people actually believe that the European economy is doing better than is the United States economy. That's bunk. That's simply not true. But you're getting a couple days' worth of data that would indicate such, and it gives the monetary authorities in Europe an excuse not to take any action at
mm-hmm.
all.
Right.
And now there's some discussion after today's non-farm payrolls that the Fed may take some action to ease monetary policy on Tuesday. Neither of those are going to happen.
Right. Here's my theory on the whole European situation. You know, we saw some better numbers out of Germany before, you know, last week or so. We saw some better numbers. Trichet said that actually he was surprised about next quarter's numbers of how they're shaping up. Here's my theory on this. We're going to see a hangover like we saw for the cash for clunkers and for the housing market with the housing credit, because what we saw was technically a credit given to Europe when the euro was at 118, 119. People rushed in, bought the products on sale, and we're going to have a major hangover now that we see the euro back to 132, 133, and the fact is that internal workings with austerity programs are not going to kick in, and this is what we're seeing, a front-end loading of next quarter's numbers that are going to fall down pretty hard at the end of the quarter. Thoughts?
It's hard for me to argue with that. I can accept that basic premise.
Yeah. It just seems like big problems there. So, really, back to the precious metals, and we'll end with this point, because I know, you know, you have, by the way, folks, the Gartman Letter, really one of the fantastic places to look for alternative trading strategies. Dennis Gartman writes a letter each and every day. I think he gets up at, do you actually sleep? But because the number, when you deliver that, it's like 4 a.m. or so, right?
Well, I arise every morning at 1 o'clock and try to have it out by 5 a.m. each day, so I usually am asleep by 10 o'clock at night.
Wow, that's impressive on its own.
Well, as I say, when you have an IQ of 68, you need to work 5 more hours a day just to catch up with everybody else.
All right, so real quickly on gold. Gold has been going up for a lot of different reasons, and of course, I know that every time you mention gold, the gold bugs get all crazy, whatever you say. You know, if you say that gold is going up, they're pissed off at you because why didn't you say it before? If you say it's going down, how dare you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the story with gold and some of these other metals right now? Is the trade of fear off the table from the aspect of Europe going down and that's what drove it up? Or is it still just simply inflation-related, which we do not see in the system?
Well, I actually think that there's nothing in the way of inflation that is driving the gold market. What's driving the gold market is gold as a reservable asset. That's really what's driving it. Do we expect to see the Indians? Do we expect to see the Chinese? Do we expect to see the Malaysians quietly accumulate or change their reserve position, their reserve holdings of gold? And the answer is probably yes. They have probably as many dollars as they want. They probably have all of the euros that they want. They probably don't have all of the gold that they want. And they're quietly at the margin buying gold. I was very bullish of gold for 2 years. Now I am absolutely agnostic to gold. Here we are at $1,210 an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
I own a little bit, as I now call it, my insurance amount of gold, just in case of disaster. But do I wish to raise that at all? Not really. I find myself becoming more and more agnostic, neither bullish nor bearish, mostly just bored by it.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, Dennis Gartman, by the way, folks, I believe if it still stands, you can get a sample subscription of the Gartman letter. We'll put a link on our website on how to get that. You just email right in, and then you can decide if you want to continue on with this subscription. Great, great information. If you want to follow really what's going on behind the scenes in the world in terms of commodities, in terms of markets, in terms of governments, in terms of a much different thing than just the daily newsprints, the Gartman letter is where it's at. I love it. Dennis Gartman, you're awesome. Thanks for coming on today, even though you are sick as can be. As I said, right on cue. I won't make
Sorry
you laugh.
Sorry about that. Thank you for inviting me, and I apologize for coughing.
I'll talk to you soon. Feel better.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Okay, be well. Cheers.
All right, thanks, buddy. Have a good one. Bye-bye. All right, so we had Dennis Gartman on, and I thought, who better to really kind of clean up the trading area and to talk about what's really playing out there besides Tom Grisafi, Indiana Grain Company, writes a great blog. This guy is the real stuff. You know, you talk about theory, you talk about analysis. When we're talking about actually trading, Tommy Grisafi. How are you, buddy? What's going on?
Good, Andrew. Month of August started off a little rough for this little trading machine, but we're getting back on track here
wheat
break here.
This wheat is unbelievable.
We just broke 80 cents in the last hour.
You know, let's talk a little bit about how you deal with this. I mean, do you think wheat? I mean, you've been limit up, right? You know, what's the story with wheat? Do you think it's still going up? Is it the trade? It's obviously a trade, but how is it going to play out?
Sure, I think it played out last night. If you look back at your charts, or your listeners do, last night, Thursday night. You know, at one point last night, we had wheat up 56 cents. Limit, again, would have been 60. And you had beans offered down 10. You had corn offered down 7. So take that trade now. Right now, if you had bought 10 beans down 10, beans are unchanged, so you'd have a 5 grand winner. If you would have sold 10 wheat against it, you would have a $40,000 winner. So
oh, wow.
Last night, you could have bought 10 beans, sold 10 wheat. You have a $50,000 winner. Same thing in the corn. A little less, 40. So that's what extreme moves we're having. The smallest trade you can make is a one lot. So, you know, a one by one had a, you know, what's that, a $5,000.
So tell people that don't know about the futures markets at all, what does a one lot cost? What is the money if you were to pony it up with real cash?
Sure. Last night after the close, the exchanges raised the margin on wheat. And I want to say, you know, because I'm a member of the exchange and own the seat, I don't really have to worry or fret too much about margin, but you need a couple thousand dollars per one lot, you know, probably $2,500 per one lot of wheat and $1,600 per one lot of corn. And so you need, you know, 20, 30, 40 grand in your account, which is funny because you need 20, 30 grand in your account to put the trade on,
right?
And the trade moved $50,000. That's how these people are getting blown out of these futures markets,
right?
And
so you also trade, do you also trade the SPOOs, and you trade everything,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a member of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and I have a seat over there. I can't say I trade the SPOOs that well, but I'd love to tell you I trade them.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's tradable, Tommy trades it, right? So, I mean,
we trade it, yeah. You know, when we're getting our butt kicked last night in wheat, we need something else to do, too. So we're trading crude oil. Since I talked to you, I became a member of the COMEX exchange, bought a COMEX seat, and also member of the NYMEX exchange, and figured at that we might as well join the Minneapolis Grain Exchange and the Kansas City Board of Trade, too, and get the whole 5 or 6 exchange thing. We'll find somewhere to make money or definitely lose money, you know.
And by the way, I'm still waiting for you, because I know you do a lot of the RV moving. You got your, you know, you got your combines you ride upon and all that. I'm still waiting for you to come down. And this is guy, by the way, folks, if you got to look at his website, because he gives a little tour of the actual trading room that you have down in the pits of your homeland area of your home, which is this amazing trading room that probably rivals anything you've seen before. We're talking about big boards and major LED screens and things popping all over. But when he goes on the road, he doesn't leave it there. He takes it with him. He's got like the RV, the trading RV, kind of like a blood mobile with all the major, you know, inventions that you have in the health area, but for trading. And I can only imagine what this looks like with a little satellite spinning on the top, redundancy systems and all that, so you can trade, because Tommy can't be too far away from the computer system for trading, right?
Yeah, in 2 weeks, Andrew, Indiana Grain's going on the road. We're going out with Pro Farmer. It's Farm Journal, AgWeb. People can go to agweb.com. If all of a sudden these stock traders are getting a little bored, they need something to trade, they can go. Everyone's calling me. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about how at Indiana Grain we thought last night was a top. Well, we were watching Mad Money, Jim Cramer, and he did a whole special on how it was time to buy John Deere, Monsanto, Potash, because wheat rallied. Well, wheat had rallied 60 cents yesterday, but what he forgot to tell you was the $2.50 rally the days before. So, you know, you get the American public watching this stuff. Also, last night, while I was getting my butt kicked selling wheat, buying beans, Bloomberg had raging fires of wheat fields.
Yeah, did you see that?
CNBC, someone called from CNBC, asked if they could do an interview. You know, no one's ever called me before. All of a sudden, everyone wants a story. Also did an interview yesterday for Associated Press. Forbes magazine did an article about Twitter and traders and farmers. And so, you know, when you get that much press and that much mainstream, we're probably real close to a top. Now, I thought last night you could sell wheat, and I told my listeners a futures line. I'm a commentator on futures line. You can go to futuresline.com and listen to that. And it's free on Sunday nights. So your viewers who will be listening this Sunday, hello, go to futuresline.com. You can listen to us talk about grains and all this good stuff for free on Sundays. I told the viewers I thought you could sell wheat up 30. Well, I didn't know we'd open and go up 50. So, yeah, I did sell it up 30. Sounds great. You're like, oh, wow, you have a big winner. Which you don't realize I had to stay up all night with a 20-cent loser and wait and hope, which is not good when you're trading, hoping. But what I see what dragged us down today is the Paris wheat really sold off hard. That's the, you know, the Europeans have the biggest problem. They buy most of their wheat from Russia, from the FSU.
Which they're But they're not going to be able to do
so. Your viewers with today.
You know, so wait, hold on a second. They're not going to be able to actually buy the Russian, so they're going to be coming somewhere else. Where are they going to go to buy the wheat?
Well, they'll have to come here. They'll have to go to Australia. They'll have to go to Canada. As you know, Canada had a problem this spring with their weather, so they're a little messed up. I think the biggest problem was that there was just big shorts on that exchange, and when people went to cover, you know, that Paris wheat went up, I want to say at one point yesterday, 13-14%.
Wow.
And I don't think they have limits over there either. They let their markets trade. No circuit breakers over there in France.
Mm-hmm.
Oui, oui.
Yeah, I hear you. But so now, do you still think that the wheat trade is kind of over here? I mean, in terms of the big moves.
It's over because, you know, they have beans down that much last night and wheat up that much. It's over for now. I mean, it's since we spoke, it's moved 15 cents. I mean, it's going to be busy for a while, but the real pain to the short is out. The shorts, you know, I get several emails last night from people who said, I sold a few calls. I didn't realize how much risk there was, you know, because when not only you become short the market, but you become short volatility.
Right.
So same as selling an E-mini S&P call, and we, you know, some form of trading options in the E-minis. When that volatility cracks up,
it gets
crazy. I guess
crazy.
In that case, it would be like selling a put, you know, and then all of a sudden we break all those handles. You get yourself a real problem.
So the you know, one of the things is with regard to this whole wheat trade and all that, this is not something new. I mean, we saw sugar go up like crazy last year with the India problem.
Sure. It went from 12 up to 31, 32, I think.
Right, and it was the same kind of
situation. And then all the way back down to 13.
Right.
And now back up to 20 again. So,
right. So would you consider looking at some of the companies that are going to have to pay more now for wheat? For example, you know, some of the ideas we had is something like going maybe, you know, long Archer Daniels, maybe in a short Kellogg or a short General Mills.
Yeah, you know, I like selling the pizza companies. It sounds silly, but I grew up in the restaurant business. So, and my brother-in-law is in the restaurant business. And when I called him the other day, told him that the price of flour was going to double or triple overnight, you know, because it hasn't hit the, you know, the retail store yet. He's like, that's going to kill us. I said, yeah, and he goes, and the fuel's going up, and then the milk's going to go up. So look at your Kraft, and you know, these people have been getting away on Easy Street because, you know, in 2008 they raised all their prices because the price of commodities went up so well. Well, as the price of commodities came back down, they kept their prices at that high level. So that's why the Kraft and all the food companies, you know, Cadbury and all them, even some of the beer makers, you know, the beer companies said, hey, we got to raise the price of beer. Our price of goods went up, and then they came down. Well, now they're going back up. So anything related to meat, milk, dairy, grains, you know, try to find a way to short that. And then what do you want to buy against that? What's your idea, Andrew?
I mean, the only thing you could think of is possibly looking at some of the nutrient companies and possibly some of the exporters, like in Archer Daniels, maybe Monsanto.
Golong, Bunge, ADM.
Yep.
And sure.
Maybe
you got it.
Gartman mentioned also thinly traded and popping pretty well is Anderson's. Does a lot of the wheat, the grain elevators,
sure.
et cetera.
Out of Ohio, yeah.
Right, and possibly
family-owned business.
And he said Midwestern-based companies.
Thanks. You know, I saw Dennis say that on CNBC.
Yep.
And whether you love him or hate him, the guy, he's a thinker. He's thinking outside the box all the time. and you really got to respect him. It was brilliant. What he said was that, you know, a few months ago it looked like, it didn't look like, he was probably even writing it in his letter, was that we were going to have deflation,
mm-hmm.
both through, you know, slow economy. Now, you know, the S&Ps are down 18 as we're talking. Things aren't looking so great. But we really felt like we were going to have low fuel costs. I heard a lot of people saying crude should be $60, $55 item. You know, we went up to $82, $83 today. And we were pretty much guaranteed we're going to have low food costs. Now, that's not the case anymore. So good news for the American farmer is that they're going to be sitting on a pile of cash
mm-hmm.
because the American farmer grew a big wheat crop, a big bean crop, and a big corn crop, and they're growing it right now. So that's why he liked the regional banks. He's saying, you know, go to the middle of nowhere in Iowa and go look at banks around there because the people who, the patrons of those banks are sitting on a pile of cash.
Right.
And they're fine. It's the rest of the world. It's Canada, Australia, Russia. They're having a problem. And then Europe and anyone who needs to eat, China, India, all the countries with all the population need to come buy our grain. So
right.
for the first time in a long time, the American farmer is going to be able to sell his or her grain at a phenomenal price. And we weren't the ones who had the problem growing the crop.
And, so and it's almost like a gift thing. For us. And it's almost like a gift that was given. What was taken was all the jobs in Louisiana and in the southeast there from the oil spill. By the way, quick question for you. 75%
sure.
of the oil has dissipated, magically disappeared from the Gulf area. You believe it?
I don't know. I'm just glad I don't own any. I'm glad my RV's not parked at a trailer park down there because,
right.
You know, I'm glad I don't own any real estate down there. I just can't imagine why someone would say, hey, I want to go buy a million-dollar condo anywhere along the Gulf. So, you know, maybe you want to sell those banks along the Gulf and buy those banks around the farming
mm-hmm,
community.
Yeah.
I'm sure the banks along the Gulf already took that hit a long time ago. So.
I hear. All right, listen, Tommy. Tommy Grisafi, a trader, and as you could hear it, he's talking about a lot of things that maybe some people don't totally understand, and talking about, you know, the one lots, talking about the grains, the peas. You know, what are the beans? Well, soybeans. But maybe you didn't know what that was. Check out Indiana Grain. Is it IndianaGrainCompany.com?
Yes, sir.
Yep, check that out. Listen to him on all this. He's a guy that knows what he's doing. And if I know Tommy well enough, he's actually trading as we're talking right now.
That sounds right. Hey, Andrew, I'll be tweeting a lot while I'm on the road. My assistant's going to be in the RV with me. We're going to go follow the Pro Farmer Crop Tour and see how we can tell what the yield is on corn and beans. They can also follow me at Indiana Grain Co. on Twitter and Grain Talk. On Twitter, so
wow, you've gotten
love to
quite.
Hear from everyone.
You've gotten quite.
Good luck, good trading.
Yeah, you've gotten quite impressive with the blogging and the Twittering since the last time we talked, huh?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. So
good stuff.
You can learn a few things on it. There's some nice people on there.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, speak to you soon, Tommy Grisafi, Indiana Grain Company. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thank you, Andrew.
Bye bye. Well, that was two action-packed discussions, wasn't it? Between Dennis Gartman talking about the various, you know, discussion about what's happening in the commodity markets and the idea of what's happening in Russia, and then following up with the trader, Tommy Grisafi. I think that, you know, the reality is that, number one, trees don't grow to the sky, so wheat's not going to go forever. And there is, though, the opportunity to make some money, not only in the commodities area, the soft commodities, wheat, you know, looking at corn, sugar, and possibly even the beans, soybeans, but also looking at the opposite of what will happen to companies like a Kellogg's, like a General Mills. Maybe even an Archer Daniel Midland on the upside. What's going to happen when prices go up? Well, there's the opportunity possibly to short some of the companies that will be very much affected by the higher prices that maybe can't pass that on to consumers right now. On the other hand, there may be opportunity for the domestic growers and some of the areas within the region that the farming is good for corn and wheat through the United States. So both of those things have opposite occurrences and different things happening. These are things we need to look at as disciplined investors and start looking at screens for companies that could really benefit and maybe screens on companies that could get hurt and look at the direct relationship. Now, of course, we have to look at hedging. Some of the companies like a General Mills or a Kellogg may, in fact, do some hedging on their commodities, on wheat, for example, and sugar, because they use a lot of it. But if they don't do a lot of that, that could be a really big problem for them. So again, food for thought, pun intended. And, you know, when you're looking at these are the kind of things you want to start honing in on. At the same time, realize something. When you start seeing on all the different, even including here, when you start seeing a lot of the same things over and over, for example, the theme of the wheat in Russia and the ban that's going on, and when you see the talk on every news station and you see that every newspaper as well as radio has the discussion about it, it could possibly be the top point. Just like we saw with the real estate market, the technology market of 2000, it could be the turning point, a time to think about going the opposite direction. Kind of like when you see things are just so bad, you don't think they can get any worse, or maybe they can't get any better, perhaps. Maybe it's a time to start going the opposite direction of the crowd. You know, we call that a contrarian play. That's a good way to look at things when you're looking at the crowd think. Don't be the only contrarian. Wait for things to start turning in the opposite direction before you jump in, and that may make a lot of money for you. Anyway, we'll wrap up this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 173, and I hope you have a prosperous week. Stay tuned next week. As I mentioned, we have Satyajit Das. We just call him Das because I can't pronounce his first name, and he likes it that way. Kate Stalter coming up, Kevin DePue, Terry Bedford, as well as some other stock ideas next week. Any questions you have, simply send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I hope to hear from you. Hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot for joining me today. Bye-bye for now.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.